The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
Israel's Security Cabinet yesterday approved plans to expand its military offensive in Gaza, which it said would result in the displacement of most of Gaza's 2.1 million people. Now, most of these have already had to move at least once during the war. The United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres has said he's alarmed at the plan, which, by the way, is not expected to be implemented until after Donald Trump's visit to the region in the middle of this month. Joining me now to look at this in more detail is Duncan Bullivant, CEO of the Henderson Risk Group. Duncan, good morning.
Good morning.
Now, this, I suppose, has been Netanyahu's ambition all along. Does it amount to an annexation of Gaza?
It's fair to say that Netanyahu has been depressingly consistent in this approach since pretty much the start of the Israeli incursion into Gaza. We know that within Netanyahu's cabinet, there are those who see negotiation with Hamas as pointless. And we also know that there are those within his cabinet who would see the northern part of Gaza returned to direct and continuous Israeli control. We also know that over the Atlantic, Netanyahu's supporter in the White House, Donald Trump, has come up with some pretty radical ideas of his own for Gaza. So in between all this, the Gazans, I think, are being squeezed by a vociferous and single-minded Netanyahu and a slightly inconsistent and irrational US view on the future for Gaza, which includes displacement of the entire population into parts of Egypt.
Now, that requires the cooperation of Egypt.
So in amongst all this...
Duncan, the question I was asking you was, it would require the cooperation of Egypt. What does Egypt need from the United States that would act as a lever for Donald Trump to force Egypt to take Palestinians?
I don't think the Egyptians will ever take Palestinians, and I don't think the Jordanians will ever take Palestinians. And this is the Palestinian curse, is that, you know, the least support they get practically are from their Arab neighbors in the region. And there's history of this, and I think this is in many ways the great tragedy of what is happening now in Gaza, is that the Palestinians have very few friends in the region. The Israelis, you know, there is a sort of belief within the Western media that somehow there is a sort of strong movement within Israel against the action in Gaza, and that time is running out and that they want to negotiate, and that is not necessarily the case. Whilst, you know, the plan that's been put forward by Netanyahu is pretty shocking and expansive, let's see what it looks like on the ground. But of course, the key to all this is control of food aid, and it's all about the eradication of Hamas as the controlling entity within the region. That's the crux of this. It's use of food as a tool. Who's going to deliver it? Can the Israelis break the back of the Hamas stranglehold on the use of food as a political tool? And so it goes on. But there is no clear long-term solution yet being tabled by the United States, by Israel, or, let's be clear, by Hamas, who still hold 24 Israeli hostages. So within all this, yet again, that 2 million-plus population of Gaza are going to get savaged, are going to go through the uncertainty of displacement. And so it goes on.
Now, we know there are some dissenting voices in Israel, people who are concerned about their surviving relatives who are held hostage by Hamas. But it doesn't seem as if that is going to stay in Netanyahu's hand. His view seems to be, well, they're probably all dead, or most of them anyway. So they will have to be sacrificed, really, on the altar of his ambition.
Yeah, I can't obviously speak for what's in Netanyahu's mind, but I think that ultimately there is a belief within their cabinet that the best way to get the remaining hostages back is by taking this action. That if they negotiate, if they get into a protracted negotiation with Hamas, it will lead to a situation where, you know, there's more delay, There's more embarrassment. There's more humiliation. And at the end of the day, it will end in a it will end where it started, with Hamas terrorizing the population of Gaza, with no security guarantees and absolutely no future plans. So I think we have to be careful to assume that Netanyahu has given up on the hostages. But I also think we must be very careful not to grasp at the fairly small minority of Israelis who disagree with the Netanyahu approach. But let us also remind ourselves that this Netanyahu government were on their knees and looking at the exit door prior to the 7th of October atrocity committed by Hamas. And I think the reckoning will come in the next 12 months or so, because yet again reservists are being called up. Yet again, reservists will the economy will be disrupted as they seek to persecute this next phase of incursion into Gaza, which brings no long-term security or stability at all.
Now, when you hear of people being moved into an even smaller area, and we always talked about Gaza being smaller than County Meath in Ireland, which is a small enough county, now they're going to be compressed to an even smaller area by the Israelis. And that is, if you like, a concentration of people. And it brings to mind, one large open concentration camp where food, certainly for the last 2 months, has been used as a weapon, which is a war crime.
Yeah, I think we've got to be careful about the language here. And I think, there have been claims over the years that Gaza is nothing more than a concentration camp, and it suffered the most horrendous time under is with Israeli participation. I think it is what it is. The Israeli position, and I think this is something we need to bear in mind, the Israeli position, and it's not just Netanyahu's position, is that Hamas are not reliable partners in terms of negotiating any outcome that sees Israel safe and provides security guarantees. So that's a fact. Hamas will never be a partner for peace in the region. And on the other hand, you've got an Israeli government who feel they have the mandate, be it self-imposed, to continue their war aim, which is to dismantle and destroy Hamas. And any sane person, which I hope includes the majority of people who listen to your show on a regular basis, would say, well, hang on, there is no solution unless it's negotiated. You're not going to beat these people into submission. So between the two, we have Gaza. And it is an impossible situation. I think right back at the beginning, we talked about this being an intractable situation. There is no clear solution. And this is the tragedy of the region. All we can do is minimize the human suffering. And that probably does require Israel to take a very deep breath, to step back, to look at, unfortunately, Hamas remaining in some form of control, and to manage the security situation the best they can, and accept the fact that Hamas is a factor in the region, and to try and to reduce the threat to Israel through non-conventional means, which, intelligence, use of special forces. But you're still going to have this issue. There is no long-term peace process that sees Israel living next door to a Hamas-run Gaza. And that's the tragedy of the situation.
Now, when you see what the Israelis have been doing, and they admit this, that they have not been allowing any kind of food aid and medical aid, and indeed fuel, to get into Gaza for the last couple of months. I mean, that's like something from the Middle Ages, the Siege of
It's
Derry. It really is. It's crazy.
is hard to imagine. It is hard to imagine. And it is, at the end of the day, children are going hungry. Food then becomes quadruples in value, if not more. Issues around food, they always say historically, don't they, that any society is only four meals away from revolution. And if you control people's food supply, you pretty much get them to do anything you want. The tragedy of Gaza is that the food is being intercepted. Food supplies are being intercepted, not all of them, are being intercepted by bad actors, who then seek to control those food supplies to their own ends. So you've got, you know, the what's left of the, I would say, the moderate population of Gaza is being beaten from both ends. It's being beaten by Hamas and beaten by the Israelis. Now, and in the middle, they're trying to get on with their lives.
Now, you talk about the Israelis regarding Hamas as not being a very reliable negotiating partner, not being reliable at all as a negotiating partner. Israel is not a reliable negotiating partner. I mean, we had the Biden plan, which became the Trump plan, which was to have a three-stage process. And Israel, maybe they claim they were provoked, but they abandoned that process completely.
Yes, they very quickly resumed full-scale military operations. And one could argue that they failed to allow the process to reach conclusion. But again, it's very easy to sit and judge both parties from the safety of Europe. And I am sure that the Israelis are privy to intelligence that we're not. And I'm sure Hamas have got their view of what was going on as well. But I think that to get ourselves into a situation where, and I think what broke the back, by the way, of the last series of exchanges was the cynical way in which the wrong body was returned. I think that broke the back of any semblance of desire on the part of the Israeli population to actually to carry on with this macabre pantomime. That said, you know, the route to peace is never easy in these circumstances. But I genuinely believe that with the Netanyahu cabinet and with the Netanyahu-led government, there is no desire for peace. The political outcome of continued conflicts and a semi-permanent conflict within Gaza plays to their advantage. And so what is the motivation? There is none. They're getting tacit support from the White House, although there are occasional statements to suggest that starving a population is not a good idea. But the reality is that the game goes on. Mm. And so I think that the tragedy is there is no political gain for Israel to achieve peace at this point.
I'm just wondering about the, you know, historic genetic memory of the Jewish people who came from Europe to found the state of Israel, along with those some of those who lived in the region already. You know, that question of what they're doing to people in Gaza, it's almost like treating them as subhuman. And, you know, you have echoes there of the Warsaw Ghetto. I mean, it's unavoidable, that resonance. And I don't know whether Israelis can even see that.
I think we have to be very careful that we don't get drawn into the Hamas propaganda rhetoric of the Israelis replacing the Nazi jet boot. I think the tragedy, the absolute tragedy of the current situation is that the majority of the people that were slaughtered on the 7th of October were the same people who desperately sought a way to live alongside their Palestinian neighbors who were not part of some extreme right-wing cabal.
They're the easy targets.
And I think that within Israeli society, there is a strong liberal pulse and a great sense of memory that goes back to the Holocaust. And of course, it shaped Israel. But by the same token, there is also a strong core within Israel who say never again. And that's the issue here, is that for them, the response to the 7th of October attack, everything is justified because they have no friends in the region. They're on their own. They're a small population, and they'll do what they have to do to seek their own security. Mm. And that's the great tragedy for the Palestinian people.
Moving on to the other theatre of war, which is Ukraine, and another person who's not regarded, well, two people, both Donald Trump and Vladimir Putin cannot be relied by Ukraine as cannot be depended upon as reliable negotiating partners, given the flip-flop in the White House and the duplicity of Putin.
Totally. But away from public scrutiny, and I think something that is perhaps not necessarily being that widely reported, is the fact that the Ukrainians, who are incredibly industrious, have got themselves into a situation now where they're only a few months off developing, well, they have developed, but going into production for their own very effective cruise missiles. They are manufacturing their own long-range artillery and increasingly manufacturing more of their own ammunition. They are holding the Russians on the front line. They're giving a few meters here and a few meters there at terrible cost to the Russians in terms of human life. And they can carry this on for month after month after month at this stage of the game. They've reached a manageable stalemate. And I think what you're going to see now increasingly with the Ukrainians is more offensive action. They're humiliating Russia at the moment. You know, the fact that Russia had to close its airports in the Moscow region because there were no safety guarantees from the Ukrainians with their drones is humiliating. We've got reports in the last 24 hours of both the Chinese and others who are attending the 80th celebrations of the end of the Second World War in Moscow. You know, countries saying, "Can you give us security guarantees?" It's completely crazy. It's like the world's turned upside down.
So
Ukrainians are in a much stronger position.
This is why Putin wanted that truce over 3 days, so he could invite his guests and guarantee their safety. And Zelensky is saying no, 30 days or nothing.
Yeah, that's it. And I think that, you know, there was a perfectly reasonable plan put forward by the Trump administration for a 30-day ceasefire. The Russians have obscurated and have avoided the issue completely. The 10 points that the Russians then put forward as their demands for peace are a joke. And, you know, the Ukrainians were never going to accept it, and the Russians knew that. They are not humiliating Trump, but they're certainly making Trump look a bit of a chump, to be honest with you. You know, it is what it is. But time at this point, ironically, is on the Ukrainian side. The Ukrainians have got themselves into a state. There's a sort of balance here, where their wartime economy is surviving. They've got enough supplies coming through to manage this stalemate. And in a year, 18 months from now, analysts far better qualified than me have made it very clear that, in their opinion, within the next 12 to 18 months, the tide will turn against Russia in a major way, because Russia's going to run out of cash. You know, you've got little factors like the oil price now is so low, so Russia's getting less foreign currency, selling its oil to the Indians and to anybody else who'll buy it on the black market. So I think that actually the cards at the moment are not held by Putin at all. And they're it's a bluff, and let's just see who blinks first. Mm. But no, I think the situation as it stands in Ukraine today, though it may be very difficult and very, very dangerous, and there's going to be tragedy after tragedy in Ukraine over the summer. But just watch what happens, because the Ukrainians are now have got their own manufacturing base back up and running, and technically they're very competent. They're developing their own long range drones and missile systems, and they're going to go for Moscow time and time again.
Finally, is that why Vladimir Putin is raising the prospect? The quote was, "I hope we don't have to use nuclear weapons before the end of the war with Ukraine." Is that what he was about, responding by trying to frighten people?
So, totally. I mean, he loves to rattle that saber, but he's rattled it so many times now that I think it's lost its effect. But when cornered, who knows which way this thing will go? All I would say is that at the outset of this conflict, it was made very, very clear to the Russian military and political apparatus that were they to go down the use of tactical nuclear weapons route, that the conventional response from NATO would be overwhelming. And that remains on the table, even despite the peculiarities of the Trump administration with regard to their commitment to NATO.
Now, before I let you go, Duncan, a question from a listener. How come the Palestinians have no friends in their own area and surrounding countries? Why is Ireland one of the loudest voices on the subject and flying their flags? I'm just wondering, why is our stance out of step with their own neighbouring countries?
I think to answer that question directly, and I won't make many friends by saying this, is that the Palestinians tend to bring trouble with them wherever they go. Because the very nature of the Palestinian cause, it requires them to support covert action, requires them to support what we would regard as acts of terror. And so within Jordan, within Palestine, within Egypt, and also within closer to home, within Lebanon, the authorities have always had to deal with factions within the Palestinian community who bring trouble, who bring trouble to their doorstep. And I think from that perspective, there's always a lack of will to see large population shifts of the Palestinian community arrive on their doorstep. And no, I think that, sorry.
No, no, I was just going to thank you for joining us, Duncan. But if you want to conclude.
Well, I was going to say to conclude, I think Ireland's position on Palestine is understandable and commendable. And I think that it is absolutely the role of countries like Ireland to shine the light and to make noise and hold people to account.
Duncan Bullivant, CEO of the Henderson Risk Group. Duncan, thank you very much for joining us.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.